This is Radio Times. I'm Marty Moscoane. Government is too often like a vending machine. You put your money in, you get a product, and if there's a problem, you shake or kick the machine. That's what Gavin Newsom writes in his new book, Citizenville, How to Take the Town Square Digital and Reinvent Government. Newsom says a government needs to be more like cloud computing, where information is everywhere and accessible to anyone at any time. The book was inspired in part by the social game Farmville, where players spend hours building and maintaining virtual farms and creating a vibrant virtual community. Gavin Newsom was two-time mayor of San Francisco, is now the lieutenant governor of California. He was a successful businessman before he turned to politics, and he joins us here in our Philadelphia studios. And Gavin Newsom, nice to have you with us.
Good morning.
On
Thank
Radio
you.
Times.
Thank you for having me.
So do you think America needs its Arab Spring, where social media was working so hard to change government?
Well, I mean, it's in the air, certainly. The Occupy movement, the Tea Party movement, I mean, change is in the air, and it has been, I think, for some time. And these tools of technology allow people to amplify voices that weren't able to do so in the past and in real time. You've certainly seen the Facebook youth of Tahrir Square. You're seeing the manifestation of this in Spain, the Ignatos. You've seen it even in China. And obviously, the contours of these changes are taking shape in America.
But what you also say is government seems to be slow to embrace these changes. And why do you think that
is?
Well,
I mean, look, when it comes to technology, we're on the cutting edge of 1973. I mean, we still have old technology from the 1970s. I mean, there are few cities across this country that have email access with their police forces. We still have these old legacy systems, these top-down systems where we've built a system that was supposed to be built to last in a world, as you say, of cloud computing, where you don't have to build now, you don't have to buy, you can literally get something on demand.
But do you think, in part, and Philadelphia, like a lot of cities, has had financial problems for decades now, do you think in part because governments are pinching pennies. They don't have any money.
In many respects, it's the IT departments that have participated in the overreach in terms of government procurement. I mean, we go to systems now that are always over budget, that are so difficult to navigate because they don't work with another system and another agency. And we all realize that when we run up against this analog world, when we go to the DMV or we go down to the clerk's office and all of a sudden their computer system doesn't match up with the system of the other agency you were just down the hall with. And so we've got to reconcile that because in our real lives, we're doing that. These tools of technology that we're using, not just the cloud and the impact that's had, but you just think about 5-7 years ago, Tom Friedman said this brilliantly. He said, you know, Facebook in his book, The World is Flat, didn't exist in 2005. Twitter was a sound. The cloud was in the sky. 4G was a parking space. LinkedIn was a prison. Apps were things you filled out to get in the University of X, Y, and Z. And Skype, for most of us, was a typo. Those things didn't exist as we know them today. Now they're ubiquitous in our lives. Technology is flattening hierarchy and big institutions.
Here's a quote from your book about IT. The traditional IT department may be on its way out. And you seem to have particular criticism for IT departments. Well, and I have to say, I don't think this place would work if we didn't have a functioning IT department.
It's a construct of an old model that no longer needs to exist. I mean, and the cloud is the great commentary on this. I mean, you know, in California, I mean, here we are, Silicon Valley, California. I'm from San Francisco, the Bay Area, leading a cutting edge. I was the first department or first agency in state government a year ago to go to the cloud. Not one agency's using the cloud. We're still stuck with these old legacy systems, 10-year contracts with some of these big, what I call IT cartels. Excuse the language. They're well-intended, but they lock down taxpayer dollars for decades and don't allow us the next generation. And so our burden is, it's why I lead in the book with my comments from the former president of Estonia. I was trying to regale him about our new Wi-Fi initiative in San Francisco and all these great apps that we were talking about at the time. And he looks at me and completely quizzically wondering what the heck I'm talking about, because he had been using these technologies for decades because they leapfrogged those legacies when they came out in 1991 of the old Soviet Union.
So it's something about our own government bureaucracy that prevents us from embracing this new technology?
It's the same thing with all big institutions, private and public. It's difficult to change. But the contours of change are intense, and they're manifesting certainly in your industry, the media. We've seen it with newspapers, the impact of blogs, and we're seeing it across the publishing industry. You've seen it notably in music. And when we look at the Grammys, we don't buy albums anymore. We buy songs. It's an on-demand resource where it's a generation now of choice. This net generation, the whole focus on digital natives. My daughter, who's 3 years old, who I thought was a prodigy, she goes on her iPad and she's doing things at one that I didn't even understand as a digital immigrant, learning the technology language. And then I, of course, bring her to preschool, pre-preschool at 3.5 a year ago, and I look around and all of these kids are prodigies, which means maybe none of them are. Their brains are wired differently. They're growing up digital.
Your book is inspired in part by Farmville, which is that online game that people play. Your book is called Citizenville.
Yep.
So how do you think the digital world then can help us deal with problems in the analog
world? Well, the whole idea is to meet people where they already are. And, you know, Farmville is an extraordinary example. It's a San Francisco-based company, Zynga. It's connected, obviously, to Facebook. Mark Pincus, the founder, is an old friend of mine. And I remember meeting Mark years ago thinking, come on, people are not going to virtually buy acorns for $50 and tend farms. This is insane. And, of course, boy, was I wrong, as the amount of people online gaming around the world is now increased past half a billion. 500 million people are spending over an hour a day online playing games. Al Gore talks about this in his book. If you're 21 years or younger, you have probably spent more time online playing games than in the classroom between 6th and 12th grade. And so the idea of gamification, we're starting to see take shape where people are using it as an education tool, not just an entertainment tool.
Well, and I'm wondering about, you know, the parallels, if there are parallels between gaming and civic engagement. And how do you make civic engagement fun?
Yeah, how do we take, and that's the whole idea of this Farmville model. I mean, people are going to tend to virtual farms. Can't they tend to their neighborhood, parklet, or to their neighborhood community or rec center? How can we translate this online behavior to offline behavior? How do we inspire these meetups? How do we reconnect by using these tools of technology that, for example, were used in Manor, Texas, an example in my book, where they created virtual civic currency called InnoBucks, where you can get, in essence, the badges that you get on these games, but you can translate those to discounts at local businesses, discounts that provide a real-world experience that gives you civic value and creates a real civic benefit.
But what you're saying is that apps are the future of civic engagement?
I think they're a big part of it. You know, I'm arguing for a hybrid. I'm not arguing for by any stretch to replace. But good example is the great work being done in Philadelphia. You're part of a group called Code for America, San Francisco-based organization. San Francisco, one of the cities participating. But Philadelphia is starting to be on the leading and cutting edge with an app store. You can go on and you can actually get government services that were designed by the private sector at no cost to the taxpayer that are exponentially better than those services that were designed by government that cost a lot of money through an old procurement process.
So we don't need government, or we don't need the government that we have?
You don't,
or the
you
kind
know,
of government that we have?
I don't think, you know, I think the world we're living in, again, big is getting small, small is getting big. This idea of selling down an idea, this top-down hierarchical formal authority, is being challenged everywhere. And so I don't think we have a choice. I mean, we can argue to an old bureaucratic frame, but it's no longer relevant to the leveling nature of technology, where we now have the tools in our hands to access the knowledge of the world that was only in the hands of those few. It's analogous, and so many people bringing this up now, it's analogous to the impact that Gutenberg had in the printing press in the 15th century in Europe, 14th century in Asia. It gave people power, that knowledge. Now, think about that's happening with the tools of technology and this world brain that's being created and this hyper-connectivity. This is that idea on a whole nother lamb.
And I'm probably going to sound like an old dinosaur here, but does an app replace police and, you know, firefighters and people that check out leaky pipes and sewer bursts?
It gives the power of the citizen information that were only in the hands of the police. It gives the power of the citizens, for example, in Boston as it relates to the fire department, to adopt a fire hydrant. So in the big storm of last week, they didn't have to spend time, money, and overtime cleaning up the areas around every fire hydrant because they literally created apps so people can adopt their neighborhood fire hydrant and keep it clear during snowstorms. Mm-hmm. So it's a way of, for example, with crime maps, these crime spotting maps, these crime maps give people in neighborhoods real-time information that was only in the hands of the elite few within the police departments because of the appification of some of these services.
In fact, you say citizens make better use of government data than the government.
Oh, of course. Our default secrecy in government, we you've seen it with the drone issue, right? I mean, even President Obama, who was the most progressive in advancing the notion of open data and open government, was his first executive order, one that really inspired me as mayor to do the same at a local level. The difficulty of this, WikiLeaks, of course, woke everyone up saying you can default to secrecy and keep data, but at the end of the day, it's data, as the old great Stuart Brand used to say, data wants to be free. It's going to get out there. And so just allow people to use that data in ways that impact and envelop in positive things in their lives. Let's not wait for someone else to do it for us.
So how much government data then should be available to the public to access? Well, how much should be up in the cloud?
You know, I mean, for me, the default should automatically be transparency and openness because it builds trust. And it's the one thing we don't have in government today. I mean, we have it more on the local level. We love to hate our local politicians. I always said people love to hate me as mayor or you know, hated to love me, whichever one, but there was passion, right? But because, you know, proximity confers legitimacy. We tend to be more local optimists and global pessimists. Mayors tend to be less ideological, more hard-headed and pragmatic. Again, whether we love or hate them, it seems to be the one form of government that's still working. And so from my perspective, the idea of transparency and openness is more intuitive to local government because you can't hide. At state level and the federal level, it's so much easier to obfuscate, so much easier to sort of default back into the old silos.
And we have about a minute before our first break here, but I'm thinking about salaries online or overtime spending online. I mean, all that would be useful
information. And I know it's been a controversy here in Philadelphia, but let me say with respect, whose money is it? It's the taxpayers.
Right.
You know, and so I get over it. My salary as an elected official and salaries of elected officials are out there. It's fair game. You know, again, this is the whole point about data and government. Whose data is it? It's ours. It's the taxpayers. It's not someone else's. Ronald Reagan, interestingly, in the 80s, recognized this. And by the way, everyone listening has benefited from this. He said, instead of having these satellites through my agency, NOAA, the Ocean and Atmospheric Association, I'm going to open up the data on the satellites. And that's the reason we have GPS. It's the reason you have the Weather Channel and AccuCenter. It's all of this data was used by the private sector more ambitiously and much more appropriately because of that treasure trove that was released. And so what else exists like satellites that we can expose to the light of day, true openness and transparency?
And that's our guest, Gavin Newsom, and joining us today on Radio Times to talk about some of the ideas in his new book. It's called Citizenville, How to Take the Town Square Digital and Reinvent Government. He has spent a number of years in government, a two-time mayor of San Francisco. He's the current lieutenant governor of California. He also made some money as a business person as well. And we're taking calls at 1-888-4-SET. Nothing wrong with that.
477-9499,
1-888-477-WHYY. Stay with us.
The Chester County Hospital supports WHYY, an affiliate of the Penn Cancer Network. They offer access to complex treatment options, clinical trials, a multidisciplinary team approach to care, and helpful nurse navigators. ChesterCountyHospital.org.
The Pennsylvania Academy of the Fine Arts supports WHYY and presents the Summer Academy for High School Students, July 8th through August 2nd. Designed for motivated high school students intent on a fine arts education, the program features college-level courses in drawing, painting, sculpture, and printmaking, and trips to the galleries and museums of Philadelphia, New York, and Washington, D.C. Registration is now open, and space is limited. Details at pafa.edu/summeracademy.
I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. We've been raising money during the winter membership campaign here at WHYY, and we still have some work to do. Our thanks to everyone who made a pledge, but if you didn't, there's still time to do it. We rely on listeners just like you to fund the programs that you enjoy and turn to stay informed. Here's that phone number. It's 1-888-345-9499, or you can pledge at WHYY.org. You'll be glad you did, and so will we. Thanks very much.
Support for WHYY comes from Sony Pictures Classics, presenting Amour, directed by Michael Haneke and starring Emmanuel Riva, now playing.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne talking with Gavin Newsom. He says a government is stuck in the status quo, needs to embrace online technology, including social media and things like games. In fact, Farmville was an inspiration for his new book called Citizenville, and he believes that access to information can empower the people and transform the government. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. You mentioned WikiLeaks. Are you a fan of WikiLeaks?
Yeah, I mean, in some ways I am, in other ways I'm not. My one fear with WikiLeaks is that if people know that all their information and correspondence is going to be exposed, they may not be as honest in that correspondence. And so in some ways, it can actually promote, if you're emailing back and forth with a colleague, a process to get to a conclusion. It may actually create a framework where people are not having those conversations as freely and not as open. But it just proves the point that you may think something, you know, it's the old adage, whatever happens in private ultimately is going to be made in public. The president's found it the most difficult way with these drone strikes and the issues associated with the legality of that, particularly with American citizens. And I just think we have to wake up to this new reality. Here's the challenge, though, or opportunity. I believe transparency and privacy go hand in hand in this respect, that you want informed consent, because privacy is being used now increasingly as a currency. If you give it up, you'll get something in return. Think about the latest app. If you actually provide your location and your searches, you'll get the next generation. You'll get the premium on that. But for me, that's a decision you can make if you're informed. So there needs to be more transparency in order to promote privacy.
But I guess if there is sensitive information then, and it's in the hands of government, who decides, you know, you can have this kind of information, but you can't have that. I mean,
most difficult thing. And there's no one answer here. There's privacy issues that are completely legit. There's public safety issues that are absolutely legit. There's the controversy around the issues of whether or not, and, you know, with the passions coming out of Newtown, do we have all of those that have registered their guns?
Exactly.
And is that data
exposed?
Which
a newspaper published.
I know. And so these are legitimate points, and it's a very difficult question. Right now, the decisions are made by an elite few, and the one thing that counters it is the Freedom of Information Act, and it's the media that's demanding it. The challenge is, the reason our default is secrecy in government is every time there's a Freedom of Information Act request, we know as bureaucrats and government folks, we know it's going to be used against us. It's tomorrow's hit piece and headline. So we try to give only the basic minimum. And so my point is, in this world of true transparency, where we're living in a fishbowl society in a glass neighborhood, and the fact that there's the WikiLeaks, and my gosh, who knows what's next in that world of anonymous and hackers and everything else, some white hot hackers and some that are doing it for all the nefarious reasons, it should be on our terms, and our default should be openness, not secrecy.
You might know where I'm going with this, but do you think people's private life is there for inspection as well? I mean,
No.
And I know that you had an affair.
Those things, you know. Look, if you're in public life, yes. It's the world you live in. I mean, we can sit here and moralize it, and we can talk about what should be. It's not fair. It's fair. It just is what it is. But increasingly, you have a whole generation that have been leaving digital breadcrumbs, and they don't understand the issue of privacy like you and I are debating it, where we want to have a little more privacy. These folks don't necessarily understand that. And so I think there is a generational component to this. I think the idea of privacy, interestingly, and I mentioned this in the book, is actually a relatively new phenomenon. You go back sort of the what we call the three pillars of history. It was local and tribal. There was no privacy in that framework of history. When we began to urbanize and centralize through industrial economy, this centralized control, we actually created a framework of privacy. There was a little more anonymity. You can live your lives in a way where you weren't necessarily, your neighbors weren't as the proximity issue. Now it's people-centric, and all of this is being blurred again, and we're sort of going through a phase where we're having to come to grips with these very difficult issues.
And do you think we will come to grips? I mean, I think it's
begrudgingly.
You know, it's tantalizing to know about someone's.
Yeah, well, we love it. I mean, there's a reason People Magazine and us do so well. And I mean, you know, it's a friend of mine, Eric Liu, said the other day. So he was driving down Seattle streets, and he looked up, and there was a billboard and said, "You're not stuck in traffic." I mean, literally stuck in traffic. Says, "You're not stuck in traffic. You are traffic." And so it's a good reminder that we are. Our behaviors. I mean, the things we detest are politicians, their lack of authenticity, their effectiveness. I mean, we are government. We are this debate around privacy. It's our own actions that are excused or not excused that ultimately will make the determination.
You use the word tribal, and I think we all have these sort of tribal impulses. But I sometimes think there's something very tribal about social media, or it can feed into a kind of tribalism.
This is the concern, is that people, you know, one person's on Drudge, another's on HuffPost. Someone is going, you know, it's like reading the Wall Street Journal or the New York Times Ed Pages, or you're a Fox MSNBC person or public radio person, that we tend to be of like mind and we tend to congregate there and sort of have this reinforcement loop. And that's a point of legitimate concern. It's even exacerbated by this interesting fact. And I don't know, most people may not know this, some probably do, but you go on your search engine like Google, there's an algorithm about 57 things that ultimately make a determination of what comes up when you search the exact same thing as your neighbor, and you don't even get the same searches. So you can say Philadelphia, and I can do Philadelphia on my iPhone, right. You can do it on your iPhone, and literally have two different searches come up, or at least 10 different searches that come up based upon previous behavior. So there's this what we call filter bubble. Eli Prazer wrote a great book called The Filter Bubble on this. That is a point of legitimate concern in that tribal context.
And that's our guest, Gavin Newsom. We are talking about some of the ideas in his new book called Citizenville, how to take the town square digital and reinvent government. He has spent some time in government as two-time mayor of San Francisco. He's currently the Lieutenant Governor of California, and we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. What does the Lieutenant Governor of California do? I mean, you've written this book. You had a show on Current TV until recently.
Yeah, no, I chair the State Lands Commission, so we deal with onshore, offshore oil issues and all mineral management in the state. I'm on the UC Board of Regents, and perhaps if there is nothing else, that's what I'm most proud of, my involvement in the issue of higher education and trying to deal with the runaway tuition increases and these precipitous declines in terms of public investment in higher education, the conveyor belt for talent, the one thing that perhaps disproportionately connected with me with Obama's speech last night was the educational component. I also serve on the California State University Board of Trustees, and I chair the Economic Development Commission. And as a guy with 17 businesses, about 1,000 employees, that one's right up my, you know, alley in terms of being natural as, you know, as a progressive Democrat that is pro-jobs, which means I'm pro-business, because I don't think you can be pro-job and anti-business, that really inspires and aspires to a more entrepreneurial frame of thinking about solving problems, more of an engineering approach to government, as opposed to, God bless my entire family, a lawyerly approach.
Well, I wonder if that in any way is related to the fact that you have dyslexia. You write about this in your book. And I know people who have, you know, various forms of learning disabilities who've been able to, frankly, use that to their own benefit and use that to think about things in sort of unique and creative ways. And it sounds like that's what you've mastered.
In my businesses, I do two things. One is I mandate every one of my companies go out of their way to hire dyslexics, and I'm dead serious. And we have a failure award, and we reward success and failure equally in my businesses. Every month we hand out a bonus. I think we're up to $800 for the person who screws up the most, because I'm rewarding initiative, and I'm rewarding an entrepreneurial frame, not who's to blame but what to do. It's why I can't stand the politics today. And I love my party, and again, I'm a true blue Democrat, but, you know, I'm not interested in who's to blame anymore. It just doesn't service my life or my kids' lives or my community's life. I want to focus on what to do. And so when someone takes initiative, even if they screw up, I admire the initiative, the intent, as long as it was enlightened. And the reward is we all learn from that mistake and move on. And that's the beauty of dyslexia. You make a lot of mistakes. Life is not so easy. My sister never had a problem with homework, gotten all those fancy places.
Good grades, right?
Good grades. I mean, I was getting the minuses. I won't say which brand of grades, just because the teachers wanted to pass me along. I was after school. I had the summer programs. Couldn't literally read. I don't think I read a book until college because it was excruciating. I mean, honestly, just excruciating. Today, it takes me twice as long to read things. I underline things. But the offsetting benefits, to your question, are glorious because I have a different framework of critical thinking. I'm able to look at a problem like healthcare in San Francisco and say, why are we focusing on insurance? Hmm. Why don't we focus on healthcare? San Francisco became the first city in the United States with universal health care, not health insurance. We did things on our homeless programs where we were handing out cash, and I'm a Democrat. I thought more is always better. And we said, well, instead of giving out cash, can we convert this to the actual thing homeless need the most? And that's housing and supportive services. And we did something called Care Not Cash. And it's just a different way of seeing problems in a way that you have to overcompensate for. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, you're just not going to get anywhere.
But was it a struggle for you to get to that point? Early on in school,
it was torture.
It can be so painful.
I don't mention it here, but I'll never forget Mr. Morris's class in fifth grade. And you just go up and down the rows of desks. And by the way, the idea that we have rows of desks and are still teaching people with mass education, I mean, that in and of itself requires a whole new book of reconsideration. But that was when you had to read every paragraph out loud. And my turn was up. My heart's pounding. Nerves and, you know, sweating kind of reminded me a little of Rubio last night without the water. And I get up and everyone starts laughing because it kind
and
of
you're
exposed.
Fifth grader, sixth
yeah.
grade.
And I'll never, I mean, that's indelible in my life. I was dumb. And, you know, it's hard. And it's a self-esteem issue, dyslexia, learning disabilities for those kids more than anything else. And it's so hard for the families. My mom worked, honestly, I'm not exaggerating, 2.5 jobs. I want to say 3. That was not the case. But she was a part-time accountant in addition to working in a restaurant. That's how I got in the restaurant industry, and part-time real estate agent. And she raised my sister and I alone. And, you know, I can't, you know, I lost her breast cancer years ago. I mean, what she went through, struggling with a dyslexic kid and having to do the work and everything, is extraordinary. So I have a bias for the parents and for these kids that are all magical human beings, but they just need to be given the tools to become enlivened.
But did someone say, gosh, Gavin, it looks like you have some kind of learning disability or some form of dyslexia?
It was my mom. You know, really? I didn't know. She never told me it was dyslexia until high school, and I walked into her closet and there were all these reports, and I didn't know what I was doing after school Monday, Wednesday, Friday. I just assumed, you know, where are all my friends? Why aren't they all with me? But there were other folks that were there. And so I thought everyone was kind of doing the supplemental. And then it was this word dyslexia. No one ever used it. No one really even understood it. I'm not that old, but no one really understood it. And then I asked her, I said, what is this? And she said, I don't want to tell you because I don't want you to have an excuse. Like, oh, well, obviously I'm not going to read tonight, Mom. I have dyslexia. And so that's what it takes. It takes one person to create, as we say in psychology, a pattern interrupt. And it's just, you know, it goes to my values as a progressive Democrat, that everybody has the capacity to flow with the forces of life. Everyone has the capacity to be fully expressive. All of us have unique attributes that make us genius. Mm-hmm. And it's about finding that and creating a construct of this commonwealth, which in many ways, mm-hmm. technology can amplify. And that's why I went down this direction.
Well, I'm wondering whether, because I think technology has helped a lot of people with various forms of learning disabilities. I mean, some people can't hold a pen and write. I mean, it's just too hard. They have a kind of dysgraphia. But give them a computer and off they go.
Yeah, it's amazing. You watch these kids, particularly with autistic kids, and what the iPad has meant to them. It's profound. There have been extraordinary studies on this. And so in games, you know, people say, well, that kid's really dumb, spends all his time online playing games. Well, how do you translate that? Again, meeting that person where they are into a way where, you remember Schoolhouse Rock?
Yeah.
All of us were entertained as a kid not knowing we were getting educated. It was a 3.5-minute clip. We all know how a bill becomes law, except we didn't talk about the persuasion industry of the lobbyists. But, you know,
it would have been another 3 minutes.
But, you know, think about that. How do you make government and governing fun again.
Mm. Let's get some callers in at 1-888-477-9499. Looks like we have Andy from Lansdale joining us on Radio Times. Andy, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi, Marty.
Hey,
thanks for taking my call. I just want to say that I very much enjoy the show, but the timeliness of the program this morning, I just posted a blog entry this morning about some issues here in Lansdale Borough with information that wasn't quite readily available to the public, and you know, through Facebook and blogs and Twitter. Just wanted to say that it makes for more interactive government, more participation from the residents.
And I should say, Andy, you're the mayor of Lansdale, just so we know.
Even better.
You dropped your lead there. You buried your lead in your call, but I appreciate the call to Radio Times.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor, for coming in. The greatest jobs in the world, being mayor of cities, truly. That said, I love what the mayor just said. It's not about treating citizens as subjects, but co-producers in their life. It's about real active participation. It's about real engagement. It's not about a town hall meeting where we're broadcasting and we answer three questions. That's not good enough. That's not real citizen engagement. How many folks can afford the time to go to a town hall? It's about an iterative process of true civic engagement. That's the spirit of our founding fathers in many ways, and that's the spirit of a vibrant democracy, and we've lost sight of that with this vending machine government we have today.
Andy, thanks for the call to Radio Times. And as I had in my intro, which I stole from your book, and I think you stole from some other people, this notion of government as a vending machine, I think it's Don Kettle, yes. It's a very apt, and I think good and visual image about government.
Yeah, I mean, because it's, you know, you vote and then I decide. We're so good at using the tools of technology, relatively speaking, to get elected. No one more extraordinary than the 2008 campaign of Barack Obama, 35,000 self-organizing communities, building on what Howard Dean had started, Joe Trippi a few years prior. And obviously, they took it to a whole nother level. The question is, why do we, after the campaign, why do we turn people's voices off? Now, in this next iteration, we're seeing with OFA, Organizing for America, now President Obama saying, you know what, I'm not going to make the mistake I made the last 4 years. I want to have a two-way conversation, because one-way conversations weren't working very well, but a two-way conversation with the public, because the conversations I've been having with Congress haven't worked so well. So he's now keeping that apparatus going, and I think it's a very positive and very thoughtful consideration.
Well, what's interesting, based on what you just said, is perhaps a president doesn't have a bully pulpit, as we used to call it in the past, where you could, you know, speak to the nation and tell people about the world.
Where's Walter Cronkite? And he can explain it all, and we have one set of information. You know, but here's my other thought, and I mentioned it very briefly. My friend Tom Peters, who I've just long admired, the business guru. Again, my business background always comes out in politics. I tend to read 9 out of 10 books I read are business books, and I try to translate that into a different way of thinking in terms of my government and policy work. But he talked about this notion of moral versus formal authority, which I think is incredibly profound and important. You don't have to be someone to do something. We tend to be looking for the guy or gal on the white horse to save the day. In California, we said it was Schwarzenegger. Didn't really work out. Then we said we're going to get the old sage, Jerry Brown, come back, and it's working better. But some folks are a little frustrated, saying, well, Jerry, you promised something even more profound than what you're delivering. And so I think we're asking, is it a Rubio or is it a Ryan? Is it, you know, Hillary Clinton? Is it a Barack Obama? We're missing the point. And so my whole argument here is these armies of Davids. Look in the proverbial mirror. The slingshot now is not a physical slingshot. It's technology. It's a notion that you can self-organize with these tools of technology. Big is getting small. We have the ability as individual leaders to make a difference. We don't have to wait for mayors, governors, and certainly congressional leaders and presidents.
And that's former Mayor Gavin Newsom and current Lieutenant Governor Gavin Newsom. We're talking about Citizenville, 1-888-477-9499. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Fox Chase Cancer Center supports WHYY. 52 years ago, the Philadelphia chromosome was discovered in a Fox Chase laboratory. The Philadelphia chromosome was the first specific genetic abnormality linked to a specific cancer. Fast forward to today, and Fox Chase is offering a new diagnostic test for advanced cancers. Through next-generation DNA sequencing, tumor-specific genetic abnormalities now can be matched to precision drugs. More at foxchase.org. Fox Chase Cancer Center, now part of Temple Health. Widener University Law School supports WHYY. Widener Law offers flexible class scheduling through day, evening, and online courses. Learning is reinforced with hands-on experience through clinics, practical skills training, and more. With a campus located in Delaware, the corporate capital, Widener Law is committed to offering a unique advantage. Learn more about Widener University Law School at law.widener.edu. That's law.widener.edu.
Inishnua Theater Company supports WHYY, dedicated to staging contemporary plays from Ireland, England, Scotland, and Wales. Inishnua is currently presenting Scottish playwright D.C. Jackson's My Romantic History, directed by Tom Ring, now through February 24th at the Off Broad Street Theater, 1636 Sansom Street. More information is online at tellthestory.us. tellthestory.us.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowane, and if you're just joining us, Gavin Newsom is our guest. He's written a book called Citizenville, How to Take the Town Square Digital and Reinvent Government. He is the lieutenant governor of the state of California, that's after his two terms as mayor of San Francisco, and he is a businessman as well. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY, covering a lot of territory in this hour of Radio Times. Let me get Charlie from, looks like Gilbertsville, to join us. And Charlie, go ahead. You're on the air.
Yes. Hi.
Hi there.
I myself am dyslexic. And when I grew up, I had no clue. And until I was a young adult, I realized I had the problem. But in my years that I became mature and an adult, I found out that most dyslexic people are doers. They are visual and they go out and do. I think our government would do much better with doers than book read. Geniuses.
oh, we hate those book read geniuses. No, Charlie, it's a great.
We're just envious. We're envious.
No, it would be wonderful. I could not complete a book. That's how bad I was with it. But yet, I made a success of my life. So, again, people are doers.
Yeah.
When they have dyslexic, and I think we should have more dyslexic people in government.
Well, there you
Charlie,
go.
Charlie,
you and I can
there,
start
Kevin.
A petition site. Let's go. I agree. I mean,
thanks,
it's
Charlie.
It's the whole idea. I mean, you can dream or you can do. Dreaming's important. Dreaming, dyslexics dream a lot. But there is, you know, you've got to manifest your ideals. You've got to be willing to take risks. You've got to be willing to go out and make something happen. And again, Charlie and others with dyslexia had to do that more often than most because the traditional paths weren't necessarily there. So we had to exercise a lot of our demons by exposing them and being willing to work through things. And that builds, you know, the sense of confidence and capacity to lean into a world where we all need to lean in. But again, back to my point I was just leading with before the break, moral versus formal authority. We don't need to wait around for people in elected office. You think about Mandela, Vaclav Havel, Martin Luther King, Gandhi. At the peak of their influence, they had one thing in common, jail time.
Hmm.
And it's an interesting fact. This is before Mandela and Havel became president of their respective countries. You can argue after Mandela and Havel became president of South Africa and Czechoslovakia, they actually had diminished voice. So it's about moral authority. It's about exercising your voice down in your communities, in your neighborhoods, your towns, in your counties, in the state, in this nation, in the world we're trying to build. And that's really what the message of Citizenville is about, is active citizen engagement. Doership, not just stewardship.
Oh, there you go.
I just made
Did
that up.
Did you just make that up?
That's another we make up oh words, dyslexics.
Charlie, thanks for the call. And all those geniuses who want to call and yell at us, that phone number is 1-888-477-9499. It seems to me we need all the brain power, you know, we can get to solve all of our problems.
We just need different connections. That's the great thing. Technology is now, the next phase of technology is convergence. You know, taking synthetic biology and genomics and combine it with sensors, robotics, and artificial intelligence. You're seeing now the application in 3D additive manufacturing, where you're literally printing things in your home computer. For $1,500, you can print out the cup that I now have, you can imagine, in my hand at home. These technologies exist, and this is what's about to take shape, and government is not prepared for it.
Mm. What's interesting is we've had lots of guests in who have their, you know, they're kind of sneaking they're sneaking their iPhone and you know, texting while we're talking, or they have their iPad in front of them. You come here unarmed.
Yeah, no, it's well, it's my back pocket, and eventually I'll have my Google glasses, and you won't know that
go.
I'm searching the internet, taking
not,
photos. I've actually know
that
everything
you're not
about
listening
you.
To me at all.
I know all your tweets. I know all your searches.
Talk about I guess etiquette, perhaps, and we sort of struggle with because this stuff is so alluring. I feel that when my phone rings and I'm driving, I am so tempted to answer the phone. And
remember the debates we were having around caller ID. My gosh, the end of privacy. What's going on? How do I block it? I mean, we're sort of having variations on that theme. I mean, this is, again, this world we're living in, and the cost of the technology is dropping significantly. The digital divide, boy, 5 years ago, I was arguing to Wi-Fi San Francisco, as I mentioned. Then it was public housing. And now I'm realizing it's not necessarily access to these smartphones as the price drops, as significant as that is, it's about the skills and knowledge to use them mm-hmm. in an enlightened way. And so that's the next, I mean, again, you couldn't have predicted in 2005 we'd be where we are in 2013. My gosh, imagine where we are in 2020 with these tools.
I do want to talk about some San Francisco and California related issues, but let me get to, it looks like Bridget from Wincote to join us on Radio Times. And Bridget, go ahead, you're on the air.
Much. I wanted to talk about, as you have done, when public participation goes from an interaction at meeting halls and becomes more online, there becomes a greater burden for the citizen then to go through a lot of information on their own. They're not in a meeting room and being able to ask questions and get answers right away. They have to go then and dig through a lot of material, huge documents, and put pieces together. And sometimes the information is just missing. And I'm wondering how we can stipulate or make sure that citizens have easier access.
That's a good question, Bridget. Thanks for the call to Radio Times.
Yeah, no, I appreciate that call and concern. But with respect to those experts in the room, particularly the politicians, this whole notion that they have all the answers and information is, you know, I think needs to be challenged. I mean, the reality is you have now access to the world's brain. And with the tool of technology. I mean, it used to be only for the elites they had knowledge. You had to afford an encyclopedia. And now you're able to go to Wikipedia, 100 million hours been spent putting that together in an open-sourced way. You have more access than the experts. And so it's about aggregation. And there are a lot of wonderful sites now that are allowing people. Quora.com allows kind of citizen engagement where it sifts through that information in a depoliticized way. It's like the old framework out of the old Greek society where 2,400 years ago, people randomly sampled, and they were the experts. So the technology, Localocracy does it. Politify has some interesting things. Zeitgeist, this is interesting. Sunlight Foundation is partnered with the Knight Foundation, and they're actually designing data, which I love, with this company called IDEO that helped build the original Macintosh out of San Francisco Bay Area, designing data, taking all of these data points, and what does it mean in my life? And they have an app now where you can break down all the census data and make it visible and real and relevant in your life. That's extraordinary, and that's the next iteration of government 2.0.
Bridget, thanks for the call to Radio Times. You can call as well, that phone number 1-888-477-9499. This goes back almost a decade, I guess, 2004. You told the clerk's office as you were mayor of San Francisco to issue marriage certificates to same-sex couples, and this was in defiance of California law at the time.
Yeah.
Why'd you do that?
You didn't have to bring that up. It's interesting. It was 9 years ago yesterday.
Because
I remember it was right around Valentine's Day. It was the week of Valentine's Day. And, I had just come back from the State of the Union with George Bush. Nancy Pelosi was kind enough as my local congresswoman to host a sort of victory celebration of my run for mayor. And I actually was given that extra ticket. It wasn't Ted Nugent in this case. It was me in the back. I wasn't sitting there with my arms crossed, though I was rather distressed by what I heard in that State of the Union from George Bush. And one of the things was, his call at the end of that speech, instead of talking about citizenship and the crescendo of that magnificent speech last night as it relates to gun issues, President Obama, he talked about writing into the Constitution an amendment to ban same-sex marriage. And I just felt this great sense of weight and responsibility and took it a little more personally coming from San Francisco and the values that I grew up around and the folks I grew up around. And I thought, I got to do something. I have to be audacious here. I've got to walk my talk to do what I think publicly, or rather privately. I got to manifest those things publicly and have the courage on this. And we decided to put a human face on the issue and married Phyllis Lyon and Del Martin, have been together over half a century. None of us, and I certainly didn't expect, I'd love to say I did in hindsight, but it's not true, over 4,036 couples from almost 50 states and 8 countries that came in to live their lives out loud and to express their love and devotion. And it, I hope it humanized the issue.
It looks like the country is changing on this. It'll be interesting to see where the Supreme Court weighs in on, number of...
You mean Justice Kennedy? Yeah,
the
Supreme Court of
perhaps.
One. Perhaps, exactly. Who knows? The Obamacare is the exception, right? It's amazing how far we've come in such a short period. I never thought in my lifetime I'd hear a president of the United States actually utter the words, I support marriage equality, same-sex marriage. But it's time for some damn courage. Excuse my language in politics. I'm sick and tired of politicians on both sides that have private thoughts that don't express them publicly because they're politically disadvantageous. Mm-hmm. I much prefer the guy or gal with the arrow in their back. And those are the people of nobility. They're not necessarily the ones with big statues, but at the end of the day, they're the real people making change on every issue. And I want to know where people stand. I want to know what they think. I don't like ideologues. Be open to argument. Be interested in evidence. But damn it, stand up on your principles. Mm-hmm. Say what you think. Lean into the world. That's why I like this new Obama right now. Our president starts saying, I believe in universal preschool. I believe in raising the minimum wage. I believe in universal health care. I believe in common sense gun control. I believe that people have a right to access the polling booth. That's the kind of guy I was inspired to support in 2008, and I'm liking this.
And this is not to diminish what you did, but back in 2004, around Valentine's Day, but you were the mayor of San Francisco. I mean, it seems to me that was a relatively friendly...
Hardly. I mean, we were barely debating civil unions there. People are having a hard time with civil unions. Remember, in Howard Dean's book, he reflects on a conversation he had with President Clinton, who said, Governor Dean, you'll never be president of the United States. You've given up that opportunity because of your support for civil unions. We had just come out of the domestic partnership debate. Remember, my biggest critics were Democrats.
Well, the
biggest, loudest critics were Democrats. And, and frankly, they've been well chronicled. I don't want to talk out of school. President, I did 2 fundraisers for him. They didn't have a photographer in there. He wanted no association.
This is President Obama?
Yeah. So, people were running. And I admire and embrace our president. I'm very proud of him. People were running away from this issue. San Francisco's never had an openly gay mayor. San Francisco, interestingly, has always supported, given a choice, the more moderate. It's a very interesting town. It's a progressive east side and a very moderate conservative west side. I came out of the old Irish Catholic west side homeowner, and so I thought I'd be recalled, and I sure as heck didn't think I'd be reelected.
Mm. I've been to San Francisco. My son lives there, and you talked about the Care Not Cash program, but I have to say I'm always shocked about how many homeless people there are in San
Francisco.
It's
bleeding back. We reduced it by almost 40% when I was there. We reduced the welfare caseload by 83%. I housed more than, and these are objective facts, and I'm preaching data, so I practiced it. Over 12,000 human beings I got into supportive housing. It's changed, and it's not an indictment of the current mayor. It's not the priority
it was. Is it the recession?
It's more than that. When things were going well, it was the cost of living. It's more complex than that. And our big challenge, and you face this here in Philly when I was walking around, in every big urban center, is the issue of poverty in all its forms and manifestations, not just homelessness, panhandling issues, which are not exclusively homeless by any stretch, issues of bipolar disorder, schizophrenia, paranoia, depression, people duly diagnosed, self-medicating with drug or alcohol addictions, family issues that are very different than individual chronic homelessness. And we've not had a president, we've not had governors in most cases that have prioritized this issue. We've seen the poverty rates in this country get worse, not better. We pay scant attention to it. That's why when the president talks about health care and minimum wage, he's starting to address the issue. But I'd like to do it by name. Let's get serious about the real issues of income inequality and get serious about the issue of poverty, because it's a national disgrace, and you cannot have a vibrant democracy with these kinds of barbell extremes.
Do you want to be governor of California?
If you're lieutenant governor, I don't know many that went, so I hate the politician says, I'm just enjoying my job and we'll see. Okay, I'm a doer. As I said, even if you don't like what I do, I'd love to get back in the mix. We got a really good governor now who's doing a very good job. California actually has budget surpluses projected. Who would have thought that 6 months ago?
Well, and without getting too much in the weeds, it's frankly shocking to read that, knowing that how big that budget deficit was.
Well, there was a lot of it was inflated.
We were
everyone was hyperbolic, you know, we're the next Greece, Romney was saying, you know, insolvency. The last 3 years, there's been dramatic cuts. The last year, the Schwarzenegger administration, and Democrats had no chance. There was no refinancing all debt. There was no capacity to do things except to make very difficult cuts, and those became structural. And so as the economy flattened out and things started coming back, and this tax increase that we did, which was about a third of the solution, two-thirds was real cuts, not one time, and the taxes, it's just put us back on a trajectory.
You have some praise for the Tea Party people or movement in your
life. Well, I like,
you like them.
You know what I like? I like people. What I hate, and this goes back to, you know, we can sit here and hold hands and talk about the world should be and have a candlelight vigil, and I'm as good as anyone else going on candlelight vigil walks and holding hands and pontificate. But I like people to get in and step in and step up. And you know what drove me crazy when the Tea Party was taking all over those town hall meetings about health care? But you know what? I admired it because it kind of reminded me of myself in the town hall meeting saying, darn it, we got to do more on homelessness and poverty. And you know what? The drug laws in this country are an abject failure. And you know what? I'm not going to sit back and justify race-based sentencing on crack cocaine. And you know what? I support efforts to regulate and tax marijuana because the unintended consequences of our current policy are failing us. If I was going to do that and upset Democrats and Republicans and I was boisterous, then you know, I thought about Tea Party. That's what they're doing with their beliefs. I don't embrace them, but I admire that.
Well, on that note, Gavin Newsom, thank you for – we could go on, but thank you for joining us today on Radio Times.
Great to be here. Thanks so much.
You're very welcome. He's the lieutenant governor of the state of California, and he served as two terms as mayor of San Francisco. And he's written a book. It's called Citizenville, How to Take the Town Square Digital and Reinvent Government. For more information about this program, go to whyy.org/Radio Times. In fact, if you go to our Facebook page, you can see what Gavin Newsom looks like.
Oh, gosh.
Kevin Griffin, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Susan Greenbaum, Patty McMahon, Dennis Devine, and Debbie Builder. I'm Marty Moscowane. Thank you so much for joining us.